Welcome to AB Testing Podcast, your modern testing podcast. Your hosts, Alan and Brent, will be here to guide you through topics on testing, leadership, agile, and anything else that comes to mind. Now, on with the show.
Hello, it's Alan.
Oh, and Brent.
Brent first. So I was just going to say hi, but then Brent started doing a very, like, imagine the worst possible dad dance ever.
White guy dad
doesn't know how to dance. Oh, yeah, there it is again. Oh, God. Like, we are a much better podcast. Hey, everybody. It's episode 198 of the AB Testing Podcast, and we got Brent and his cat here. Another reason. We got to start. If you and I weren't so damn ugly, we should totally, like, live stream our podcast.
It would be, I mean, us being ugly isn't the blocker, number one. Yeah. I mean, I've seen worse on YouTube. Okay. Number two, though, this is where it does become a problem. Like, if you're really concerned about that, like, doing the whole, like, extra editing of video to, like, fuzz out the fact that I'm a fatty fat ass from Fatty Land. Yeah, it just seems like more work and you know, low maintenance, better.
I don't know. Oh, it's freaking tax season, and I'm poor.
When did that happen?
When I left Unity, I had a whole bunch of stock options at a price I could not let expire, so I bought them all.
Oh.
Now I got to pay the AMT on all those things.
Yeah,
I'm still going to be net ahead. This is a first world problem. I'm just going to sell some of them because now I'm past the tax period. I'll get the money. It is definitely a first world. I'm complaining I have to give some of my money to the government. Unlike our former presidents of the United States who never have to do anything and be accountable ever, I am accountable for my fines and my taxes, and I'm going to pay them. No political comment.
Me too. The only thing I would say is I've had TurboTax tell me for multiple years in a row that I should be doing AMT. And I just went, no. Thus far, I haven't had a love letter telling me otherwise.
Yay, Brent. Okay. All right. On with the show. Here we go. We have a new segment. I do not have a theme song for it, but it's going to go into a topic I wanted to discuss with you because it involves our time together at Microsoft and before, and I have a whole arc. An arc, Brent, an arc in my head.
Oh, in your head. Okay.
In my head, and you're going to discover it as we go. The new segment, and I'm going to write a song for this at some point, but the new segment is called What's on Alan's Desk?
Okay. What's on Alan's desk?
So a couple things.
It does feel like it should be like jazzy.
Yeah, I got to work on it. My voice is a little better. I'll lay something down. But I bring it up because right before we talked. Actually, I loved our last podcast. The editing, I didn't get like bored and mad. It's like, yeah, I like this topic. And then Jason Arbin messaged me from my basement. Okay. On LinkedIn and told me, because he lives down there apparently, and he told me he was excited about all the things we talked about, and anyway, because you can do this, you just have to do blah and hook up the reverse ornithopter into the subjugated A positive terminal on the, and I'm like, okay,
I am certain you're paraphrasing
slightly, yes.
Yes.
So, the reason I'm bringing that back, because last week I had How to Measure Anything, the wonderful Hubbard book, on my desk, because I was going to write a blog post about it, but I also wanted to talk to you about it, because I don't know if we've ever talked about that. Have we talked about How to Measure Anything on the podcast much?
I am...
Maybe a long time
long
ago?
Long time ago. Okay, whether we have or not, I have distinct memories of us doing so because it's fantastic.
Okay, I have another book on my desk that you probably haven't read.
Our books are kind of fetish, right? We've definitely talked about that one.
Fetish. Yeah, okay.
Right, we talked about that one. We talked about Reese. We talked about Reinertsen's book. Nicole is our current favorite, unless you're about to show me a new
book. No. This is an old book, but it's relevant. Okay. I've been thinking about it a lot, And I'm probably going to write a blog post about it this weekend. But I realize there's so much – I want to talk about some of the transitions Microsoft went to. And we can talk about when I was there about some of these things. And I want to hear some of your – don't tell me anything you're not allowed to, but it's fine. I think you'll get where, I think you'll get where I'm going. But before we get there – I want to show you a couple things. Well, this one isn't hooked up yet. I spent a lot of time this weekend mucking around with just setting up a bunch of Docker containers to do random crap on my network. And I have all of my CDs ripped to FLAC.
To FLAC?
It's like a zip file for WAVE. It's compressed, but it's completely lossless.
Okay.
And over time with Spotify doing what they do.
You do that?
Like 3 or 4 years ago.
Okay.
5 years ago.
Years ago, I did, the MP3.
Yeah.
And I still have them. And I'm like, okay, there's better things now. But I just don't feel like doing it again.
So I'm not going to do it again. I'm going to take my CDs and try and find out what one does with like 3,000 CDs. I also have all of my FLAC audio.
Let me know, because I don't have 3,000, but I have at least 700.
When I moved the time before last, I found a couple huge stacks of blank DVDs. I thought, what the fuck am I going to do with these? So anyway, FLAC backed up to Glacier Storage, cost me like $2 a month to keep them all backed up, so I will never have to record them again. But also, they sound better, noticeably better compared to an MP3, and probably half my CD collection is unavailable on Spotify, so all good. And I have an old Kindle that I haven't, Kindle Color thing, whatever it's called, Kindle Fire. And what I can't do with it is anything because it's old and slow and can't be upgraded anymore. But I want to see if I can get use it as a controller for one of the, I installed a music indexing service and then put a subsonic output on it so I can play it to my Sonos speakers. And I want to see if I can make the only thing blocking me now is easy access to control and play those. So that's on my desk. Little hacking project going to happen this week.
Oh, so you're going to hack your Amazon Fire and make it into a Zoom?
Well, we're going to see. But even better, we get a little deeper here. I am recording on my very nice MixPre 3. We used to have you coming into track 3 on this over the internet via USB. You are now coming your own audio track on Riverside FM, which I'm very happy with because it allows me to do things like this. And not only are they recorded for you and I to hear if all goes well, but it also is recorded right into track 3. So the backup recording I'm making has this, and it sounds like this. Mailbag.
Awesome.
Oh yeah.
Awesome. So you are now like even closer to like a real DJ.
And I want to be a DJ, and I'm going to edit this part out for surprise.
Oh.
That's going to be fun too.
I have absolutely no control. I have no idea how many buttons you've implemented.
I have it going on, Brent.
It makes me so happy, and I can only imagine how happy you are.
All of our paid subscribers will be so happy. So, yeah. All right, so many of the things on my desk, I'm not going to talk about all of them. It's kind of what's new. So, I don't know about you, man. My desk is like, I work here, but it has the stuff I want to keep at hand, like Accelerate, Lean Startup, Lean Analytics, Reinertsen book. They're all over there. But occasionally a book that it's influencing me, Brent's trying to distract me, finds its way to my desk because it means something in the moment.
Okay.
And I don't know if you ever read this. This was written by, holy cow, in the late 90s? 2000s, early 2000s.
Okay.
Do you remember Bob Herbold?
Why do I know that name?
He was
That's someone I know, right?
Yeah. He was the COO at Microsoft in the 90s and early 2000s.
Okay. I don't know personally, but yeah.
And before I go on from there, I didn't know at the time. I was young and dumb and new. But I can talk. It's been over a year. I don't think there's any NDAs nor anyone cares, but when I decided to leave Unity, Unity was an absolutely fantastic place to work with really, really great people. I just disagreed with the direction the leadership was like. I was leadership. The two levels of leadership above me, our COO and our C-suite, were going in. And I'm not going to go into names of the idiots on there, but I felt like our CEO, John, who I really, really liked, and he was really good. It was just a little bit, again, this is me observing from the side. It was too big for him. He was better in a smaller org. I don't know if he didn't know how to ask for help or he got the wrong help. But I remember having long conversations with my boss, the CTO, saying, John needs a COO, an operating officer. He was really good at interfacing with the customers and figuring out where we're going and kind of being a face. Someone needed to run the company. It's kind of like what I did for a lot of my managers at Microsoft. I would say, you manage the people, I'll run your business. But anyway, yeah. That aside, I didn't know what he did. I actually wanted to do this job. I know they'd never hire me for it because John wouldn't have hired anybody for that job because he didn't want to get the help. But anyway, seeing him as a COO made me think about that. But the reason I bring him up is he wrote a book, came out in early 2000s. I can't find a date on here, so I'm going to say early 2000s. It's called The Fiefdom Syndrome.
I have not read that book.
Not many people have. And I don't even remember. I do remember why I bought it. And I'm going to come back to that.
Because freaking the company was riddled with that shit.
Well, it was. And I was young enough and new enough in my career. It rang true to me. And then when I read the book, it's like, holy shit. And some of this comes from Procter & Gamble and other big companies. But a couple things I'll talk about while you're typing and looking up. I think we all know it. Like, I talk about silos often. Fiefdoms and silos, they are from the book jacket. Because it's way better than ChatGPT. The problem begins when individuals, groups, or divisions, out of fear, seek to make themselves vital to their organizations and unconsciously or sometimes deliberately try to protect their turf and gain as much control as possible over what goes on. One, it's interesting because I forgot that pockets of this exist in the industry. I remember it at Microsoft. I remember it so well. I can tell you so many stories. In fact, I'm going to tell one bad Microsoft story. And then I want you to talk to me like, I don't quite remember how it got better. I was involved in some of it, but I hurt my shoulder like a long time ago. It hurt to reach behind me for like a year. And then it didn't, but I didn't notice when it stopped. It just kind of was gone. And maybe I just stopped paying attention, or maybe I made my own fiefdoms. I didn't pay attention. I want to talk about that a little bit. But the story I want to tell around fiefdoms is, one of Microsoft's all-time best programs ever, something a flagship that they should really hang their hat on is Microsoft SharePoint. Sarcasm.
SharePoint's still a viable product. It's
all right, let me finish my story. Early 2000, Stack Overflow was going gangbusters. They didn't have the whole Stack Overflow thing. In fact, way back then, they had a business model where they would license Stack Overflow to corporations to run as an internal Q&A site with all the goodness of Stack Overflow to kind of archive knowledge. At the time, and probably still today, you don't have to let me know, but at the time, Microsoft had dozens and dozens, if not hundreds of DLs where people discussed everything from Win32 programming to C++ to COM to SQL Server to blah, blah, blah. Special interest groups, DLs. Tons and tons of them.
Yeah, that still exists.
Okay, so at the time, so I thought, wow, because I was a big Stack Overflow fan. I was an early user. I thought, we need to get that for Microsoft. That's about when I was working in that EE group, and I had autonomy to go talk to them. So I did. And I won't say I talked to important people there. And I got us the deal of the century to bring Stack Overflow into Microsoft and get all that technology here. The only worry from my senior leadership at that time, the only worry was, what if, because we wanted to get it for just, let's just use it for these teams. And what if everybody uses it? I was like, oh no, what if? Super excited. we are down to like, we're ready to put a contract out and they're going to fly out and get it set up for us. And some senior leader in SharePoint blocked it. He said, no, everything they're doing are features we're going to have in SharePoint someday. So we don't want you bringing this in. It's worse. It's worse. So that was like, okay. And for years, I had a doc on our intranet. People would go to our internal site and they'd email me for years going, hey, this ever, what happened to this? What happened? And it was blocked. So not only did this VP in SharePoint, SVP, GM, whatever he was, block our usage of Stack Overflow, they insisted that I cut off my conversations with the folks at Stack Overflow completely. They made me ghost them. I couldn't even tell them we weren't pursuing. I just had to ghost them completely, what was the guidance I got. It's one of the most angry times I've ever been in my life. And I just want to make a good thing happen for everyone. And I got waylaid by someone trying to build a fiefdom.
Did legal give you that guidance, or was it?
No. It came from, I don't know where it came from. It eventually came through me through my boss. It said, this got blocked, blah, blah, blah. And you are not to say one more word.
Okay. Well, if it came from your boss. That...
Anyway, fiefdoms. Actually, I'm going to shut up for a second because I have all kinds of stuff from the book I want to bring up. But we used to have a lot more of those at Microsoft. And even in the end when we still had competition, a little bit of backstabbing. But I don't remember the fiefdoms. So do you remember what happened to them all? Or are they still there and I didn't notice?
Oh, no. There is remnants of them still here, but it's now remnants, right? It's essentially Satya has slowly but surely chipped at it. And it's, I think working at Microsoft, you wouldn't recognize it nearly as much. I was trying to load up the old school diagram of like the Microsoft communication structure, where it's essentially orgs all pointing guns at each other.
Yeah, yeah. That was right. Very famous. It's amazing. Probably once every 4 or 5 months, someone will send that to me and say, have you seen this? It's hilarious. So, yep.
Yeah.
Lived it.
And glad it's dead. There's still, every so often, I see it pop up. But the number of times I go, what a bunch of old school crap, right? That has rapidly fallen. Like, I think I have said it twice in the last 2 years, right? The idea of collaboration, partnership, psychological safety, that is absolutely on the rise.
What?
Yeah, absolutely.
I didn't know anyone at Microsoft could pronounce psychological safety.
We do have the education team. I mean, what are they doing? Yeah. but if you think about it back in those days, right? So number one, Bill Gates very famously would give two entire divisions the same mission, right? When I first started, right, Exchange owned email, the server, and Schedule Plus, right, the calendaring app. And
I forgot that it was called Schedule Plus. Anyway, go on.
Yeah, that was – actually, I have it here.
No, it's all right. It's all right, man.
You Visual Aids. Check it out. It's the only – remember back in the day when you ship something, you got it?
I know. I got a Windows Millennium box on my bookshelf over there. So
the only one I kept was Schedule Plus because that was
I just need to have a bonfire.
That was my first. Anyway, back in those days, they would literally set up things, number one, where divisions – would compete with each other without realizing they were competing with each other. I remember when it bubbled down, it took like a year before the Exchange team learned that even the Outlook team had even been formed. We're like, what the hell is this crap? What's going on? Right? Now, where does the fiefdoms come from? My hypothesis is people are trying to get control
mm-hmm.
because they're in an incentive model that encourages blame.
Yeah, and that right? Herbold says some of the same things. I agree.
The Welchian model that Steve Ballmer was in love with, right, a.k.a. the bell curve model.
Oh, yeah.
Okay? That incentive model, number one, does not work in the software industry. It was developed for sales team, and it makes sense in the sales team.
Ballmer only knew how to run sales teams.
Right. And so that has caused a lot of harm.
Yeah.
And it's actually still causing harm, right? I have young kids coming out of college. Like you and I have talked about, I think we've talked about, I actually believe that in high tech, we're going to see overall the value of high tech skills from a price tag, from a salary point of view. The supply of people with these skills, particularly with LLM and things like that, is far greater than the demand. And so I expect to see sort of a salary adjustment on that front over the next 10 years.
Let me expand on that. I want to get back to fiefdoms and just a little bit more how they went away. But I think you're on to something there. I think the technical skills they're on a path to be overrated and perhaps overpaid.
Yeah.
I was talking to someone last week and actually I'm got re-invited, renewed. I'm on the alumni board at my old university because I'm a big liberal arts fan. Talk about the how important it is to be able to talk to people and influence people and get along with people and emotional quotients. And I think people with critical thinking and high emotional quotient, that's like the new top knowledge worker at some point.
I would add one more to that, and I almost think I would put it top of your list. You probably have a better way of phrasing it, but I think I've especially told my daughter this. I think the jobs of the future, the number one skill set is the ability to learn and apply in the shortest amount of time.
We read that in A Whole New Mind by Pink, or I read it in A Whole New Mind by Pink, talking about the rise of the knowledge worker in general, because that's what knowledge workers do. And good knowledge workers have short feedback loops on their learning. One of the things I've looked for decades now in hiring is not your ability, Google, to sort a binary tree while standing on your head drinking a jar of Kool-Aid. It's the passion for learning.
Yeah.
Like 100%. If you look at, I was AA at Microsoft. I've hired, 1,000 people, whatever, maybe less, but a lot of people. The ones that I got to follow, like the people who were definite hires for me, is like, I would ask questions, try and gauge their passion for learning. Like, and the canonical example I use, I probably told this on a podcast once, but I look for the things on your resume that aren't tech, because by the time you get to me, you've had the tech questions. I say, oh, you're interested in photography. Cool. Tell me a little bit about that. Oh, I like to take pictures with my phone and I save them. And sometimes I send them to my family. That's answer one. I go, oh, that's great. A little bit sarcastic. And I get person number two. I said, well, tell me about that. And they say, oh, I really got into it last year. And I got this. I learned about this camera, talked to a friend. So I went to this internet site and I learned this. And this, I do this. And I go to, I organized a photography critique. Once a week we meet and each go over each other's photos. We try and find different ways to improve them. I do this and that's like, okay, that person is going to be successful in any field of knowledge work. The fact that you're a kick-ass programmer too, come join my team. Come today, tomorrow. All right, sit there. Right next to me. It's amazing success rate. Those people, they don't flame out and dud. They crush it.
I have a new employee on my team. Relatively, well, it's the newest. And I don't know if she still listens, but when she joined the team, she was listening to the podcast a great deal. So if you're still listening, hi, Katie.
Hi, Katie.
She joined the team, and Microsoft started this new type of interview style, and it is literally off of potential. We literally do not care if you know anything. I don't know the questions, but she got hired through this potential process.
Okay? Very cool.
She.
How come you fixed all the broken stuff that nobody gave a shit about after I left? Just asking. Asking for a friend. Anyway, go on.
Maybe you were the final straw that where
sure,
the company realized. Yeah,
that's what happened. Oh, no.
Oh my God, we lost Ellen. We need to make a change. She came in. She has a PhD in cognitive science. Like, she literally was doing brain surgery on rats as part of her doctorate and postdoc work. Okay. And she has a bunch of fun stories of, about that process. I'm enthralled by it. I'm fascinated by it. Okay. Now, she did some stats work for her PhD. I don't know how many PhDs you can get and not at least do some stats work, but really didn't know much about data science, does not know much about development, but she is hungry to learn. And the one thing that I got into her very quickly, and this is something where a lot of the PhD candidates I've talked to, they struggle with this. I got her to understand very quickly that ideating in academia is well praised. Ideating but not executing in industry is a coffin, a nail in a coffin.
But it seems like, so, I mean, and that's a common trap PhDs fall into when they come
in. It is.
So kudos on you for calling that out. But based on what you told me already, I don't think it would be an issue.
It really isn't. Like, there was a couple of times I'm like, hey, you're doing it. Like, let me give you. And so I had to, like, observe her, see what she was doing and make adjustments and say, look, you can do. Like, what she, as an example, she's like, okay, I don't know what I want to execute, so I want to explore a bunch of stuff. And I said, how about this? You just pick one, close it, think about the things that you're exploring, and then you can iterate. Fast feedback loop. And she's starting to do that. And it's just fantastic. I view her as a long-term investment, and the more knowledge and how to do things I can stuff between her ears, the better this company is going to be in the long run. I am now having her entirely own an entire service by my team, which involves code and it's ML backed and including like the deployment and into production, which has to go through all of these security bars. Right. And she just joined us this August. I think it will be 2 years.
TLDR, Brent has an awesome new employee hired on potential rather than lead code. So you brought up something in there that I want. This is a point I wanted to get to, but you also mentioned it, long-term investment. Growth. Here's my worry. I was listening to The Daily Show, not the good one at night, the podcast. It's called The Daily. And last week they had an episode talking about the aging workforce and how 20 years ago people weren't working into their 60s, but now with longer life expectancies, people are going to work till they're older. And who knows if I will or not, but got me thinking about me. I thought, no. I mean, I may, but here is the challenge. The problem is, and Satya was a 10 out of 10 hire for Microsoft. But I talked about John at Unity. He was very much old school, RTO, some stuff he's very, very strict on. I worry that some of the things that Herbal talks about getting rid of fiefdoms, just like, you know, clear goals, transparency, psychological safety, engagement, you know, learning, the things that are important to growing a great org are not in the wheelhouse for, like, if you look at larger companies, they're, I mean, even Satya's late 50s, early late 50s, but he's an exception. He has a high growth mindset.
Yes.
What I worry about is companies across the board, but I worry that they're going to have CEOs who are going to work into their 60s and 70s. And they will stick, let me finish here, and they will stick to their old guns and do stuff the old way. When honestly, I want, this is the whole thing with the president. I want a freaking 45-year-old president. I want a 40-year-old CEO. There are people capable of doing it. I want people with new ideas and about how these knowledge workers we talked about earlier and what we need from them. I want people who get that leading the companies, but I don't think we're going to get that in my lifetime.
How do I want to say this on recorded podcast? Let's try it this way.
Sometimes I just say it, and because I own the editing, I just fix it later.
Right. You're like, oh, no, I didn't say it that way. I actually said it this way. Yeah, I think I talked about it on so D&I. Like, I'm a huge supporter of D&I.
That's diversity.
A huge supporter of diversity and inclusion.
Yeah, Brent, who's going to say they're not?
Well, so here's the thing.
I get what you're saying, but go somewhere.
No, so the diversity and inclusion, right? I went and looked at the research, okay? And shocking, the research does not show that it has anything to do with what body parts you have or don't have, what color your skin is or isn't, or in this particular case, your age. What the research shows is that people with certain body parts show a characteristic, okay? And it's that characteristic that matters, okay? So, for example, specifically women. Companies who have women CEOs dramatically outperform companies that don't.
0% surprised.
Now, the question is why? And one of the big characteristics is that women generally, number one, are more cautious around risk, whereas men generally, you're going to see them, we are going to bet the farm on this. Like, I am never working for that guy again. That person who's like, we are going to bet the farm, take the hill. I'm never working for that guy again. Okay. And I've worked through many of them, Brian Valentine. Women are also more collaborative. They value more of a partnership. Right. And so, sure, if you want to improve your company and you don't want to do the hard work, sure, go by body part. That's fine. But the thing is, it's hire the collaborator. Hire the someone that doesn't make artificial, hyperbolistic visions. We will win, blah, blah, blah. Right. And on the ageist side, like the thing you're talking about, it bothers me because I'm like, okay, like, you don't want the 40-year-old person. What you want is the guy that is just masterful on the growth mindset.
Yes, and what I'm saying is, you're absolutely right. What I'm saying is, my hypothesis is they do not have, like, the odds of me finding a growth mindset in a 40-year-old are much higher than a 65-year-old white dude. That's my hypothesis.
Okay.
Go run the data.
And what I would say is, yeah, I'm still not willing to use that as a heuristic. I would rather spend the extra time and say, okay, if we're going to do something like that, like, and honestly, I think it would potentially make a lot of sense, because I will say, I absolutely think, for example, corporate heads inside of China, which is something I think about in terms of a competitive high-tech environment. I think they, in general, are much more growth mindset than the tech CEOs here in the United States.
So in my position, I'm obviously like 150 years older than everybody on my team. But I look at the one-on-ones and meetings I have as kind of a reverse mentorship, at least partially. I learn, like, I get so much hope from people that embrace growth and love to learn. And I don't get that. I'll use the Unity example. It's like being stuck in your ways. Like, I'll tell you about a conversation I had you'll love with a different exec at the previous company. Sorry, I know people from Unity list. I'm not... love the company, didn't like where it went. So I'm not picking on you. It's just you do you. I had a conversation like this. I was right before a bunch of layoffs happened. I was involved in a discussion to experiment with the 4-day work week. There is a bunch of data showing it works. Nobody's ever done it with the big company, and I get it. And I did this because we're going to weave our way back to the FIFA syndrome eventually. I did this because at Microsoft, as you know, Brent, you don't stop accruing vacation ever. It just cuts off at the end of the year whatever your max is. You can only carry over your max. Maybe that's changed. Don't wreck me here. What I didn't realize is that when I went to Unity, you would get to a point anytime during the year if you had your max vacation accrued, you just didn't earn vacation. So I was like not getting vacation while I was working. I was at my max. And screw this, gotta take some vacation days. It's a pandemic. I got nowhere to go. So I took like every Friday off for July and August. And there's some reasons that that was not as good as it should have been, because my team and teams around me were working on those days, so some work was piling up. But I got more done in those 8 weeks than I probably did at almost any other time. Because a couple things happen. One is, you know, you're only working 4 days, you focus and bear down a little bit more, but that's barely it. That's maybe at most 10% of the productivity. The amount of extra productivity you get from it, it's not the 4-day work week, it's the 3-day weekend every week and planning on that. 1 day to rest, 1 day to get shit done, 1 day to sort of mentally prepare. So anyway, I loved it, pitched it. A bunch of people were excited about it. There's a channel, we're talking about it. I had an idea for a pilot. I convinced HR, they didn't know what it meant, but we talked through it. Okay, we're going to do this. Then things got weird with layoffs, a bad idea. But I presented all this data. This is a long story. I didn't even need to tell. And Brent thought in his head. But we had an exec with a huge background in data. And he said, he just told me flat out, 4-day work weeks don't work. I said, what about all the data supporting it? He goes, I don't believe that data.
Okay. Well, there you go.
I'm lost. This is critical thinking too. Anytime, if you tell me something I don't believe in, I'm not going to want to, it's stupid. If you tell me, actually, if you look, the sky is always brown, I go, oh, well, I think you're wrong, but I'm going to go do some research and figure out why you think that way. And maybe there's a condition, maybe there's something. But anytime I get data that I have cognitive dissonance, I am driven to go figure out where that motivation for you to tell me this obviously wrong thing is coming from. And sometimes I find out that I'm the wrong person, and an unwillingness to do that is unhealthy for leaders.
You cannot. So your hypothesis, the way I think of it, is you cannot have a growth mindset and an active confirmation bias simultaneously. I think if that's your hypothesis, I think I agree.
Okay.
Right.
That's it.
It's people who, well, I have all this data. Well, I just don't believe it. Well, can I see it? Like, I will tell you like an event that happened, the other day. So I've been, there's a certain set of like Azure-wide strategy meetings that I often get called at. And this time I got called in, and they're like, hey, we want to make this change on this KPI. We want to push this out. We want to understand what you think. And I started off with, okay, well, I don't have this data. Can someone give me a histogram? And they were like, the hell? Like, to them, which was mostly program managers, but to them, that was like a – like an out there question, like what? And I saw the histogram. The histogram looked exactly what I expected it to look like. And so I asked them to do a transformation on this. Okay. And then I was like, oh, ho, ho, look at this. And I walked through and I said, this is what this is saying. This is what this is saying. I very transparently was the data whisperer. This is what this means. This is how you handle it. This is why I'm suggesting this. And I walked through and I answered their question, but it did a long term. Okay. I found out today that at least one of the PMs who is very data savvy, he just hasn't learned it. Like, this happened a week ago and he's still freaking talking about it today. He's like, oh, that thing that Brent, like, it was like I gave him a brand new toy at Christmas, which I did, by the way, because this is very lightweight. It's very approachable. And I'm like, we need more of those people that listen and can think for themselves and learn the technique and apply it to new things, and less of the intuitionists like I have been here forever, right? And,
That I've done this for 20 years. I know what I'm doing, son.
Yeah. If your tenure is part of your title, it's time for you to go, right? If your qualification is purely measured, it's not it. A growth mindset it's got its pros and cons. Like I'll tell you. So I actively have a growth mindset. I invest in things. And I will tell you, sometimes there are years where none of them land. And you know what? We're valued on the results that we brought, and I accept that. Okay. But when they do land, they land major. Okay. And it's okay. It's okay. I'm not going to get awesome reviews every time. But the fear of, oh, I am going to get blamed, and therefore I am going to get into the shit score in the bell curve, and then fired, and then I and my family is all going to be homeless, living in a box next to the 7-Eleven, right? That's not effective. Driving productivity, when Microsoft did it in those worlds, that fiefdom mentality, helping you to circle back to the...
Yeah, and you were there a second ago.
I'm going back.
We're there.
Right. The world of that fiefdom mentality, back in those days, Microsoft, I swear to God, this is true from my experience. On a day-to-day basis, we spent at the ground level far more of our time competing with each other than competing with our competitors.
Yeah, and there's a famous Simon Sinek story. He talks about he went to visit Microsoft, was at a leadership offsite, and they spent the whole time talking about how they were going to beat their competitors. It's adjacent to what you said. He went to an Apple similar meeting, and they spent all day talking about how they were going to please the customer. And yeah, it's not vibes. So what's interesting, you're absolutely right that this fear of failure, this fear of blame, this I got to make myself important is where fiefdoms come from. I'm not going to hypothesize about Satya, but Herbold talks about like the solution to fiefdoms is pretty simple. Clear organization-wide goals, and leaders are on point to foster a culture of collaboration.
Yeah.
And which is, we all have our principles around that, but psychological safety is part of it. You have to give people room to experiment, room to talk, and room to fail, room to learn.
Number one, I really like what you just said. And I'm wondering if there's some sort of maturity model there. Like,
God, I hope not.
Lois is you're competing internally within your own company. Two, you're competing externally. To me, it does feel like it's a better approach to say, hey, look, let's figure out how to make the customer happy, right? Because the problem with like competing, and this happened in the incentive model. If you and I were competing with each other, I don't need to be good. I just need to convince others that you were worse.
Absolutely. 1,000,000% yes.
And when you go after, okay, how do I get customers to love us? No, now you're changing the bar. You have to be good. Not just the least sucky. I like that. There's one last thing that I was in a meeting that so I attend a lot of meetings nowadays with senior executives. And I was with one, this was 4 or 5 years ago before COVID, okay, with Scott Guthrie. Do you know who that is?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. And he made a statement that I think about every week. Literally. It has stuck with me, and I may actually circle back with him. And I said, you probably said this out of hand. I may circle back with him and just ping him on it. He's like, I want to be the apple of the cloud. And I'm like, that is a rallying cry I can get behind. Right? Yeah. I love that idea.
And just real quick, a rallying cry or this is where Andy Groves, we talked about OKRs, and we can't even use OKRs anymore because they've been so corporatized and toolized, they've lost their entire meaning. But all it means is the organization agrees on what's important, along with some measurements on how they know if they're making progress towards that goal. I'm not going to walk through the exercise of be the apple of the cloud, because that's great. I mean, it helps people align. If you can have a clear message on what's important and the team aligns around it, you're going to have fewer fiefdoms.
The problem with something vague like be the apple of the cloud, right? That's open.
Yeah, I was going to do a whole workshop there. We don't have time for that, man. I just want to talk about fiefdoms. I think we did that. We told some stories that some were sort of relevant to that, and some were just made up shit that someone skipped through. Plus 30 seconds, plus 30 seconds.
Right. And I will say, I mean, just like what we've talked about with modern testing, right? The new world is better than the old world.
The new world is going to be so much better. Yeah, it's
nice. No, it is. The current world, better than the old world. The new world, as long as, you know.
What about the new world?
Yeah, it's.
We'll figure it out, man. We'll figure it out.
We will.
All right, let's call it. I am still Alan.
And I am not.
See you next time!